She was leaving it up to Sebastian to discover for himself what that reason was. Chapter 22. Sebastian came out of Connaught House's snow-blanketed front garden to find his tiger walking the chestnuts as far from the site of the old execution scaffold as he could get, and still be within hailing distance. At the sight of Sebastian, the boy swung the sleigh around with a swish that sent up an arc of fine snow crystals. He was just reining in before the house when Sebastian spotted Signor Valentino Vescovi's lanky figure coming through the Tyburn Turnpike to stride purposefully toward Princess Caroline's gate. "Hang on a minute," Sebastian told Tom, and shifted to intercept the harpist. The Italian had his head down, his attention all for the task of minding his footing on the slippery footpath. He remained utterly oblivious to Sebastian's presence until he said cheerfully, "Good morning." The harpist's head jerked up, one hand flashing out to grab the railing of the garden's iron fence, as his feet slid sideways in opposite directions.
"Santo cielo, you startled me."
Sebastian thought the man looked more frightened than startled, but all he said was, "You're Vescovi, aren't you? I heard you play at one of Lady Farmington's musical evenings last September." "I'm Devlin." Vescovi licked his lower lip.
"If this is about Signora Ambrose, your wife has already spoken to me, yesterday."
"I know." Sebastian threw a significant glance toward Caroline's tall stuccoed house. "What are you doing here?" Vescovi swallowed.
"Teaching the Princess of Wales to play the harp?"
The excuse might have sounded more believable if the rising pitch of his voice hadn't turned what should have been a statement into a question.
"Indeed," said Sebastian. "She's very musical, you know." "As is her daughter."
The Italian nodded vigorously.
"Yes, yes."
"How convenient that mother and daughter share the same instructors. It must make it so much easier for them to pass letters back and forth with none the wiser." Vescovi stared at him in silence, his dark eyes watering, and the tip of his long, thin nose red from the cold. Sebastian said,
"Do I take it Jane Ambrose also carried messages for Princess Charlotte?"
Vescovi blew out a harsh breath and looked unexpectedly troubled.
"Not to my knowledge, no."
"And would you know?"
"I think so, yes."
"So why was Jane here last week visiting Caroline?"
"Was she?"
"I've no notion."
He tried to sidle around Sebastian toward the garden gate, but had to draw up again when Sebastian shifted to cut him off. Sebastian said,
"Tell me what happened last week between Jane Ambrose and the Dutch courtier Peter van der Pals."
He thought the Italian might try to deny all knowledge of the incident. Instead, he frowned and said,
"Why?"
"Because there's a good possibility it may have something to do with Jane's death."
"Was she in love with him?"
"Jane? Of course not. I suppose she was amused by him at first. He's a clever, witty young man, and he made her laugh. But if he believed her to be captivated by him, he was mistaken. She was shocked when he tried to coax her into spying on Charlotte."
"How do you know this? Did she tell you?"
The harpist's thin, bony body swayed from side to side as he shifted his feet in the snow.
"It's complicated."
"Court intrigues generally are," said Sebastian.
Vescovi nodded and sighed.
"Jane Ambrose was a talented, good-hearted woman, but she was too naive, too trusting to survive at court. She made the mistake of telling one of the prince's sub-governesses about the entire incident with van der Pals."
"You mean Miss Ella Kinsworth?"
"Yes."
"And Ella Kinsworth told you?"
"Signorina Kinsworth? Ah, no. That woman is as determinedly upright and fiercely loyal as Signora Ambrose."
"But they weren't as careful as they should have been. They were overheard."
"By you?"
Vescovi gave a sharp shake of his head.
"Me? No. By Lady Arabella." Who the blazes is Lady Arabella?
The Duchess of Leeds' daughter.
And this Lady Arabella told you about the conversation between the two women?
Yes.
Why?
Vescovi looked confused.
Pardon? Why would Lady Arabella pass this information on to you?
Because I am teaching her Italian.
Sebastian studied the harpist's thin, bony face.
That doesn't explain why she would think you'd be interested.
Vescovi brought up one hand to scratch his forehead with the seam of his thick woolen mitten.
She knew I'd be interested because in addition to everything else, Jane told Miss Kingsworth that Peter van der Pal said, I spy for Carolyn.
Why would van der Pal tell her that?
Because Jane was so shocked by what he was proposing that he laughed at her, called her a fool, and told her everyone at Warwick House spies for someone.
Vescovi scowled.
He illustrated that point with me. So whom does Ella Kingsworth spy for?
Vescovi shrugged one shoulder.
The regent assumes she is his creature, but she's not. Her loyalty is to Charlotte, as yours is to Carolyn.
Vescovi's eyes narrowed.
I serve both princesses. And if their interests don't align...
Who do you serve then?
Vescovi remained silent.
Sebastian said,
You do realize you've just admitted you had a motive to kill Jane Ambrose.
The Italian's jaw sagged.
Me? What? But how?
She knew you spy for the Princess of Wales, and she told Charlotte's sub-governors.
But I didn't hold that against her.
No?
You resented it enough to have words with her about it. I assume that was the subject of your quarrel by the canal in the park.
Vescovi was breathing hard, his chest jerking with his agitation.
I simply wished to make certain she understood the situation.
And what is the situation?
I pass letters between the princess and help keep her highness informed about her daughter. That is all, all.
You explained this to Jane Ambrose.
I did, yes. So you see, I had no reason to kill her.
Vescovi stared back at him owlishly.
None. Then you should have no difficulty in telling me where you were Thursday afternoon and evening.
Vescovi focused his attention on neatening the bright red scarf he wore wrapped around his neck.
Signor, prompted Sebastian.
The Italian carefully aligned the ends of his scarf.
I was in my room at the Percy Arms in Red Lion Square.
I was unwell that day.
I can check on that, you know.
Sicuro, said the harpist with solemn dignity.
But Sebastian noticed his hands were now shaking so badly that he gave up trying to arrange his scarf. As they drove away from Connaught House, Sebastian said to his tiger,
Valentino Vescovi claims he was in his room at the Percy Arms on Red Lion Square all afternoon and evening last Thursday. After you take care of the horses, why don't you go around there and see if you can find someone to verify that?
Tom sat up noticeably straighter, his eyes shining with pride.
Aye, my lord.
So van der Pals was the figlio di puttana, who told Jane some unflattering truths about Valentino Vescovi, said Hero, as she and Evelyn joined the crowds walking across Blackfriars Bridge to stare down at the frozen Thames.
Apparently.
Devlin paused, his gaze on the snow-covered river below. Most of the spectators were content to watch from the safety of the bridge, but a few of the braver, or more foolhardy, were venturing out onto the ice itself, laughing and calling to others to join them.
What a hideous hotbed of spying and backstabbing that household is. Poor Princess Charlotte. Imagine growing up alone in such an environment.
Poor Charlotte indeed.
Hero glanced over at him. Do you believe Carolyn's tale, that Prinny tricked his daughter into agreeing to this vile betrothal?
It sounds like him, doesn't it?
It does, rather. She was silent for a moment.
Just when you think you can't despise Prinny any more, you learn one more disgusting detail about his treatment of his wife and daughter. When a prince pays people to stand up in court and swear to a vile collection of lies about his own wife, I suspect there is little he wouldn't do. Out on the ice, a bagpipe player began to play a jig, and a laugh went up along the bridge as a man near him began to dance. Hero said, "How deeply involved in this tangled mess do you think Jane Ambrose was?" Devlin shook his head. "I'm not sure. But her visit to Carolyn last week is more than a bit suggestive. First Carolyn, then Lord Wallace." Hero watched an acrobat turning handstands in the middle of the river. "I wonder what else my friend Miss Kensworth didn't tell me."
"If she's protecting Charlotte, it could be a great deal."
Chapter 23 Princess Charlotte's noble governess, the Dowager Duchess of Leeds, typically attended her charge between the hours of 2 and 5. The exception was on Sundays, when Her Grace put in an appearance between noon and 3, which was how she came to be crossing the entrance hall when Hero arrived at Warwick House that afternoon.
"Ah, dear Lady Devlin," said the Duchess, intercepting her with a tight smile. "What a pleasant surprise. Unfortunately, Princess Charlotte is at present indisposed, so that neither she nor Miss Kensworth will be able to come down. But do say you'll join Arabella and me for tea."
"That would be lovely, thank you," said Hero, with an equally false smile, as she allowed herself to be shepherded into the dilapidated drawing-room that lay just off the entrance.
"Have you met my daughter, Lady Arabella Osborne?"
"Lady Devlin?"
The slender young girl, rising from the room's threadbare silk settee, was so lovely it was hard not to stare. Just 16 years old, she had flawless alabaster skin, a perfect nose, and a trembling pink rosebud of a mouth that seemed to smile shyly. But when Hero met her eyes, she found them a shrewd, icy grey, as hard and unfeeling as granite. "I do hope there's nothing seriously wrong with Charlotte," said Hero, taking a lumpy, high-backed chair by the fire. Lady Arabella gave a pretty little frown.
"What?"
"Her sudden illness."
"Oh, no, not too serious," said the Duchess, settling beside her daughter and reaching to pour the tea.
Born plain Miss Catherine Anguish, she had begun life as the daughter of a barrister from middling gentry. She owed the coup of her splendid marriage to her beauty, which in her youth was said to have rivaled her daughter's. Now, in her 40s, she was still an attractive woman, although tiresome, with a tendency to tell long-winded, boring tales about her own health. She'd also allowed her elevation to the rank of Duchess to go to her head, acquiring a well-deserved reputation as an insufferable snob who treated anyone she considered her inferior with ostentatious condescension, and she considered anyone not from a ducal or royal family her inferior.
"Truth be told," said the Duchess, handing Hero a cup, "the child has the constitution of an ox. I, on the other hand, have been most dreadfully plagued all winter by a severe inflammation of the lungs. Why, just yesterday, the Regent sent his own dear Dr. Heberden to check on me. 'Your Grace,' he said to me, 'your sufferings would crush the spirit of nearly anyone. Yet you bear it all with the fortitude and determination of a saint.'"
"A saint? How admirable," said Hero,
resigning herself to an excruciatingly detailed recital of Her Grace's shortness of breath, the pinched nerve in her back, the phantom pains her numerous physicians feared might mean gallbladder problems. Finally, after some 10 minutes of this, Hero managed to stem the recitation of ills long enough to turn to young Lady Arabella and say, "I understand you're learning Italian."
"I am, yes,"
said the girl, carefully settling her teacup into its saucer. The Duchess beamed.
"She's quite the linguist, you know. She was already fluent in French, and she recently learned German as well.
German. An unusual choice, said Hero.
The princess and Miss Kinsworth are both fluent in it, you see, and had taken to conversing in the language so that no one else could understand what they were saying. Unfortunately, as soon as Arabella mastered German, they switched to Italian.
Cheeky of them, said Hero.
Lady Arabella threw her talkative mother a warning frown that appeared utterly lost on the Duchess.
You've no idea, she continued. Charlotte is quite the little hoyden. Just last week she locked poor Arabella in the water closet for a quarter of an hour and refused to let her out.
Oh? Why?
Why? Well, you know, she said vaguely. The girl does that sort of thing all the time, I'm afraid. She shakes hands with men as if she were a man herself. Strides about with all the boisterous energy of a general reviewing his troops, and laughs nearly as loudly as her mother. One would think no one had ever taught her how to behave en princesse. But believe me, Lady Devlin, I have tried.
I've no doubt you have, murmured Hero. Between the hours of 2 and 5, or 12 and 3 on Sunday.
Have I ever? She's horse mad, of course. Gallops all over the place when she's out at Windsor. No one can stop her. Not even her grandmother, the Queen. The way she sets her horse at any jump she sees, it's a wonder she hasn't broken her neck.
She must be an excellent horsewoman.
The Duchess sniffed.
I suppose she is. I wouldn't know. I myself do not ride.
Hero took a slow sip of her tea.
I wonder, did you happen to see Jane Ambrose the last time she was here?
Oh, no. I don't come during the week until 2 o'clock, you know.
Do you have any idea why she died?
She slipped on the ice and hit her head, of course.
Except that she didn't. Not really.
The Duchess met Hero's gaze for one telling moment, then looked away.
I'm afraid I don't know what you're talking about.
Hero raised one eyebrow.
You aren't concerned that her death might have something to do with Princess Charlotte?
The Duchess froze with her cup raised halfway to her lips. It was left to her precocious daughter to give a trill of artificial laughter and say,
Mercy, no. Whatever gave you such a notion?
Mainly Peter Vanderpoel's recent attempts to convince Jane to spy on Charlotte for the House of Orange.
Mother and daughter exchanged glances again. Then the Duchess crimped her lips into a tight, supercilious smile.
Dear Lady Devlin, I've no idea who told you such a thing, but I fear they were having you on, as the young gentleman liked to say.
She set aside her teacup with an awkward clatter.
Now, do tell me you and Lord Devlin are planning to attend my al fresco breakfast this Thursday.
I'm calling it a winter wonderland in Kensington Gardens, and it promises to be something quite out of the ordinary. The Queen herself has promised to put in an appearance, you know.
We hope to be there, yes, said Hero, who had intended to decline the invitation due to her state of mourning for her mother. Now she wasn't so sure.
Lovely, said Her Grace.
Hero set aside her own cup and rose to her feet.
The weather should make it interesting.
The Duchess gave another of her brittle smiles.
I think we can all contrive to keep warm. The snow will make it unique, don't you agree? Like our own exclusive frost fair.
Quite, agreed Hero, thinking Lady Leeds's inflammation of the lungs obviously wasn't severe enough to keep her from braving the elements in her quest to give a party that would be the talk of the Tom.
I did see something recently that made me wonder about Mrs. Ambrose, said young Lady Arabella, walking with Hero to the door.
Oh, said Hero. What was that?
I was here earlier than Mama one day, and happened to glance out the window just as Mrs. Ambrose was letting herself out the gate. There was a carriage waiting for her in the lane. I thought it odd enough that I paused to watch, which is how I happened to see a gentleman step forward just as she was closing the gate behind her. They spoke for a moment, Then he helped her into the carriage and climbed in after her.
When was this?
2 weeks ago, last Thursday.
Do you remember anything about the carriage? Asked Hera.
It was a nobleman's barouche. I know, because I saw the crest on the door. A gold chevron against an azure background, with a rampant lion below and two castles above.
The girl gave a slow, knowing smile that came perilously close to being a smirk.
Perhaps you're familiar with it?
Yes, said Hero, who had grown up with the Jarvis coat of arms. I believe I am.
Chapter 24
Then the Lord put forth his hand and touched my mouth. And the Lord said unto me, Behold, I have put my words in thy mouth. Jarvis ostentatiously bowed his head as the glorious Stuart-era poetry of the King James Bible echoed around the soaring interior of the 16th-century chapel. He'd never been a particularly devout man, but he had a healthy appreciation for the role religion played in maintaining order and the hierarchy of being. And so he was careful to be seen attending services every Sunday, for it was important that members of the ruling class set a good example for the ignorant masses below them. He often worshipped here, at the Chapel Royal in St. James's Palace, both because its schedule was set to accommodate the late-rising habits of His Highness the Prince Regent, and because he appreciated the exclusivity of its congregation. Attendance today was sparse, owing no doubt to the severity of the weather. But one of the few worshippers present was that abrasive Whig politician, Phineas Wallace. And because Jarvis knew it would irritate the man, he found himself faintly smiling as the reading continued.
See, I have this day set thee over the nations and over the kingdoms, to root out and to pull down, to destroy and to throw down, to build and to plant.
Unlike Jarvis, Phineas Wallace was not known for his regular church attendance, but the fiery Whig orator had been trying without success to arrange a meeting with Jarvis for days. And so Jarvis was not surprised when the Baron fell into step beside him as they left the chapel at the end of services.
"I take it you wish to speak to me," Jarvis replied pleasantly. "I know about your scheme," said Wallace, his voice pitched low.
Jarvis paused to extract his snuff-box from his pocket and flip it open.
"I never imagined that you did not."
Wallace threw a quick glance around and leaned in closer.
"It's madness, all of it. Why tie Britain to the Dutch in a way that will obligate us to come to their defence? The people of this land are on their knees after more than 2 decades of war. They need peace and prosperity, not more war. The cost of defending the Netherlands would break us in every way imaginable. Break us!"
Jarvis lifted a pinch of snuff to one nostril and smiled.
"The Bourbons will not move against the House of Orange."
Wallace gave a harsh, breathy laugh. "You genuinely believe that the French will meekly accept the Bourbons back on the throne? After 25 years of liberté, égalité and fraternité?"
"After 25 years of liberté, égalité, and fraternité, there are scarcely enough Frenchmen left alive to sing La Marseillaise, let alone object to anyone we should choose to place at their head."
"It won't always be so." Jarvis closed his snuff-box with a snap and stepped out onto the snowy flagway.
"Then when that day comes, we shall have our dear allies, the Dutch, as a bulwark against a resurgent Republican France."
Wallace kept pace with him.
"This isn't actually about the Dutch or even the French, is it? It's about Prinny's bloody crusade to rid himself of his wife. He thinks that with Bonaparte defeated and Charlotte forced to live most of the year in the Netherlands, Caroline will leave England for the continent and then he'll finally be able to push through a divorce. Do you blame him?"
Wallace's thin nose quivered with his disdain.
"She is his lawfully wedded wife, and has borne nothing but insult and abuse from him since she first landed on our shores. And you think that excuses her behaviour, do you?
What of the opprobrium he has borne as a result of her conduct? Oh, please. Everyone with any sense knows he paid that Douglas woman to stand up and swear she saw the princess give birth to an illegitimate son.
Jarvis calmly slipped his snuffbox back into his pocket.
Are you so certain she did not?
When three different physicians who treated her during that period, her dresser, and the chambermaid who changes her sheets all swear it never happened? When the friends who saw her every week laugh at the possibility? When the prince is now paying Lady Douglas a tidy pension for life? Don't be ridiculous. Jarvis gave a negligent shrug.
Yet many people do believe it. In the end, that's all that counts.
And the truth?
The truth has nothing to do with it.
Wallace shook his head, his jaw set hard.
Charlotte knows of her father's intentions. She will never allow herself to be forced to leave the country. She has been warned of the consequences to both her mother and her own position as heiress presumptive to the throne. And because she knows her father, and the way he lies and feigns affection to get what he wants, she will insist that safeguards are written into the marriage contract before she signs it.
She'll sign. She's already agreed to the betrothal. These clever little machinations of yours are all too late.
It won't be too late until the vows are said.
Perhaps.
But they will be said. Make no mistake about that.
Not if I can help it, said Wallace curtly. Good day to you, sir.
Jarvis smiled faintly as Wallace strode angrily away up St. James's Street. He was still smiling when his daughter Hero came to stand beside him.
I thought I'd find you here, she said.
Oh?
They turned together to walk down Cleveland Row.
Do I take it from your scowl that you've learned something? Something you believe does not cast me in what you consider a flattering light?
You sent one of your men in a carriage to pick up Jane Ambrose as she was leaving Warwick House exactly 2 weeks before she was killed.
Why was that?
And if I told you the woman was spying on Charlotte for me?
I wouldn't believe you.
Not unless you were forcing her to do so against her will.
When Jarvis remained silent, she said,
So were you?
He kept his gaze fixed straight ahead.
Hero's nostrils flared on a quick intake of air. I would think you have enough spies around the princess, including a certain very beautiful duke's daughter with a gift for languages and the lethal instincts of a barracuda.
One can never have too many informants.
Perhaps not. Especially when you're plotting to manoeuvre Princess Charlotte out of the country so that the regent can replace Caroline with a new wife and beget a new heir. Now, wherever did you hear that?
From Caroline.
Really?
Interesting.
She's no fool.
That's debatable.
She says Prinny was virtually impotent 19 years ago, which is quite believable, given the rumours one hears about his current so-called mistresses.
When Jarvis remained silent, she said, If what she says is true, the chances of the prince producing a male heir at this point are decidedly slim.
Slim, perhaps, but not impossible.
What's wrong with Charlotte?
She's far more stable, responsible, and just plain likable than her father.
And the people love her. They cheer her every time they see her.
She is a woman.
So was Queen Elizabeth.
Queen Elizabeth lived in a far different age.
Are you suggesting that the Elizabethan era was more enlightened than our own? Or simply less challenging?
Jarvis drew up and turned to face her.
The last thing the 19th century needs is a woman on the British throne, especially one who believes in Catholic emancipation and Irish independence.
Ah, so young Charlotte actually is a Whig, is she?
Fervently so. Her becoming queen would be an unmitigated disaster.
And so you're marrying this innocent 18-year-old to a foreign prince with a known preference for handsome courtiers.
How can you do that to the poor girl?
I'm not interested in what's best for Charlotte. My concern is what is best for Britain.
Hero studied him through narrowed eyes. Why would someone kill Jane Ambrose?
I've no idea.
He was aware of Hero's gaze still hard upon him. I don't believe you, she said. At that, Jarvis laughed out loud and looped his arm through hers. But all he said was,
So are you planning to bring your son to see your grandmother this afternoon? I've no doubt she'll complain that he's interrupting her nap and fatiguing her in every way known to man. But I doubt she'll live to see many more of his birthdays.
Chapter 25 That evening, Alistair James St. Cyr, the fifth Earl of Hendon, and the man known to the world as Sebastian's father, paid a visit to Brook Street. He came to wish young Simon a happy birthday and to present the boy with a mechanical turtle, which the child adored. Afterwards, Sebastian set up the chessboard on a table by the library fire, and the two men sipped fine brandy while an icy wind howled around the house. There'd been a time, not so long ago, when Sebastian had believed the breach between them would never be healed. But things were easier these days. Not exactly the way they had been before, but easier. It didn't take Sebastian long to realize that the Earl's mind was not on his game. After Hendon lost first a rook, then his queen, in careless moves, Sebastian said,
Somehow, I don't think you came here simply to see Simon and play a game of chess.
The Earl drew his pipe from his pocket and leaned back in his chair as he began to fill the bowl. He was a big man, with thinning white hair and a heavy-featured, jowly face. Lately, he'd begun to shrink as his shoulders rounded, but as Chancellor of the Exchequer, he was still a force to be reckoned with in the government. Like Jarvis, he was a strong Tory. He was also one of the few men in London sometimes willing to stand up to the King's powerful cousin.
"Stephanie came to visit me yesterday," said the Earl, tamping down the tobacco with his thumb.
Sebastian took a long, slow swallow of his brandy and felt it burn all the way down. Stephanie was one of Hendon's two grandchildren by his firstborn child, Amanda. The 19-year-old's marriage the previous September to the handsome and dissolute and deadly Viscount Ashworth had troubled everyone who had the girl's best interests at heart.
And?
Hendon sighed.
Officially, her child is due in June. But anyone who sees her most surely knows she'll be lucky to make it to March.
She'll hardly be the first.
True.
Hendon bit down on the stem of his pipe and thrust up from his seat to reach for a spill. He sucked on the pipe, then cast the spill into the fire.
She had a bruise on the side of her face. Claims she did it falling on the ice. But you and I both know better.
The two men were silent for a moment. Sebastian said,
I can try talking to him, but the man doesn't frighten easily. And the truth is, short of killing him, I'm not sure what I can do.
Hendon sighed.
I know. It's just so damnably frustrating. She'll never leave him, no matter what he does to her. She can't. You know the law. If she did, she'd have to leave the child with its father.
Yes. Hendon sank back into his chair. He stared at the chessboard for a moment, then struck out with his arm to sweep the pieces from the board with an explosive, bloody hell. It was a startlingly uncharacteristic display of frustration and temper. He looked at the scattered pieces sheepishly.
I beg your pardon. It's quite all right.
Hendon rubbed a big, blunt-fingered hand down over his face.
I hear you've involved yourself in the death of this pianist.
Yes, said Sebastian. Hendon had spent the last 3 years complaining about his son's participation in murder investigations. But now he simply shook his head and said,
It's troublesome.
Sebastian rose with the Earl's empty glass and went to refill it.
Why?
What do you know? The Earl's jaw tightened.
You've heard of the Orange Alliance Jarvis and the Prince are pushing?
I have. Are you suggesting it could have something to do with Jane Ambrose's death?
I don't know what I'm suggesting. But she is the niece of Richard Sheridan.
Sebastian paused with the brandy carafe suspended above the Earl's glass and swung around to look at him.
She is.
Richard Sheridan was best known as a brilliant playwright and poet, and the former owner and manager of both Covent Garden Theatre and Drury Lane. But he was also, until recently, a long-time Member of Parliament and a fiercely vocal reform-minded Whig. Although no longer in office, he had not been silent about his opposition to the idea of an alliance with the House of Orange. And along with Whigs like Henry Broome and Lord Wallace, he was a well-known ally of the Princess of Wales in her struggles against the Regent.
By marriage, at any rate, Hendon was saying. His first wife was one of Thomas Linley's daughters, as was Jane Ambrose's mother.
Thomas Linley had been a famous tenor, music teacher, and composer, whose numerous musical children were legendary. Sebastian set the carafe aside.
That throws an entirely different light on everything.
Hendon met his gaze. He was not smiling.
Yes, I rather thought it might.
Chapter 26. Monday, 31st of January. At 10 o'clock the next morning, Hero and Alexis Sauvage passed through the forbidding portal of Newgate Prison and asked to see young Amy Hatcher. No one questioned their interest in the condemned girl, for earnest, devout gentlewomen, eager to save souls for Christ, frequently visited Newgate to pray with prisoners on the eve of their executions. Hero saw no reason to enlighten the authorities as to their true purpose. Hero had never considered herself a particularly sensitive person, yet there was no denying that when the heavy barred door clanged shut behind them, and the prison's foul stench and endless cries of despair enveloped her, she felt her breath catch and her stomach heave. Everywhere she looked, she saw dirty faces pressed against bars, and filth-encrusted hands reaching out to her for succour. "It's medieval," she whispered through the scented handkerchief she held against her nose, as their escort led them down a dank, noisome passage to a small, frigid room, empty except for a crude table and benches.
"I expect it hasn't changed all that much in the last 500 years," said Alexei, her own voice pitched low.
Hero waited until the turnkey left to fetch the doomed prisoner, then said,
"You've met this girl before?"
Alexei nodded. "I try to come every week or two to visit the women and children here and provide what medical attention I can. Needless to say, they don't care if I'm officially licensed or not. They're simply thankful for any help they can get. Amy hasn't been at all well, and she's so terribly frightened."
"How old is she?"
17.
Hero stared up at the room's single small barred window which looked out onto a soot-stained brick wall.
"Dear God, that's so young to die."
"One of the worst parts is that because she's from Devon, she has no family or friends here. She's utterly alone."
"Whatever possessed her to come up to London?"
"Ignorance and desperation, I suppose."
The turnkey came back then with a heavy tread, pushing a thin slip of a girl ahead of him with a harsh,
"Get in there, then. Don't want to keep the ladies waiting."
The girl, Amy Hatcher, walked awkwardly, thanks to the heavy leg irons she dragged. She was pasty white with fear and ill health, her hair hanging in unkempt clumps, her dress a filthy, tattered rag. In her arms she held a tiny infant that mewed faintly as the young mother clutched the child tight. Then her terrified gaze slid over Hero to the Frenchwoman, and her haunted blue eyes lit up with hope.
"Oh, Mrs. Savage, it's you. They didn't tell me it was you."
Alexei went to take the girl's arm and draw her over to one of the benches.
"Here, sit and eat. I've brought you bread and ham."
The girl tore into the food as if she were starving, which she doubtless was, for provisions in Newgate were notoriously meagre. While she ate, Alexei introduced Hero and explained her interest in the girl's story. Hero began by asking about Amy's family. Her parents were dead, and about her life in Devon. Then, slowly, she worked around to the night Amy's husband was captured by the press gang.
"They got him one evening when he went to meet some friends at the pub," Amy said.
She'd finished eating now and was simply holding her baby with her head bowed.
"I'd heard the press gang was in the village and begged him not to go out, but it was his best mate's birthday. He swore he'd be careful, only he never came home. It wasn't until I went out the next morning looking for him that I found out what had happened. They got Mick Tiddler, his mate, too."
The girl fell silent, her gaze on the infant in her arms.
"How old is your baby?" Hero asked quietly. 4 months.
Hero had thought the babe much younger, for the child was painfully thin and wan-looking. But Hero smiled and said, "She's lovely." The girl's answering smile cut Hero to the quick.
"When was your husband impressed?" she asked.
Amy Hatcher sucked in a quick, painful breath that shuddered her chest.
"Last July. We'd only been married a few months. After he'd gone, I didn't know what to do. So once Hannah here was born, I came up to London looking for him.
I know now it was foolish, but..."
"You walked all the way from Devon to London carrying your baby?" "Yes, m'lady. I didn't have no money for the stage. Sometimes a wagoner would stop and give me a ride, but not often."
The girl's face crumpled, her lips quivering as they pulled back in a rictus of fear and gut-wrenching pain. "My baby's gonna die, isn't she? Without me to feed and hold her and take care of her? Hannah's gonna die!"
For one uncomfortable moment, Hero's gaze met Alexei's.
What could they say?
"Your baby might survive?"
Everyone knew the death rates for children thrown on the parish ran as high as 60%, if not more. For an infant this young, already ailing, the chances were slim to none.
"I'll leave money with the keeper," said Hero. "You'll have good food and a bed tonight."
The girl murmured her thanks, but Hero could tell they were half-hearted, for Amy Hatcher was moving beyond concerns for such earthly comforts.
"Last night," said the girl, "they took us into the chapel and made us sit in the black pew with a coffin on the table in front of us, while the chaplain read our burial service and told us how we were being punished for our sins, just the way God says we should be."
The girl sucked in a quick, frightened breath. Hero thought it a senselessly cruel thing to do, to force condemned prisoners to listen to their own funeral service and a blood-curdling description of the flames of hell awaiting them.
"I always used to believe in God," the girl was saying, "but I don't no more. Why would a God who's truly good and kind let that press gang take my Jeremy away from me like that? We were so happy. We thought we had our whole lives ahead of us."
Tears began to slide down the girl's dirty cheeks, but a rush of what looked like raw anger now glittered in her eyes and hardened her features.
"I don't care what the chaplain says. I won't pray to God and ask him to forgive me."
"For what? For trying to keep my baby alive?
Why should I have to ask God's forgiveness for that? If there is a God, and he did this to us, to my Jeremy, to my Hannah, then I don't want to see him. I don't want to go to heaven and live with somebody who's that cruel and uncaring."
She looked from Hero to Alexei as if searching for an answer. But Hero felt her throat close up as the words of comfort she sought proved elusive. How do you console a 17-year-old mother who is about to die at the hands of her own government? The truth is, you can't.
Chapter 27. The day was turning increasingly cold,
By the time Sebastian knocked at the small ramshackle brick house on Savile Row, now inhabited by Richard Sheridan, a fierce wind was howling down the street. One of his generation's most successful dramatists and a respected member of government, Sheridan had been the toast of London for decades. But he'd taken a massive financial loss when both Drury Lane and Covent Garden burned within just a few years of each other, and he'd always had a tendency to live beyond his means. With the recent loss of his parliamentary seat, thanks to an ugly quarrel with the regent, he'd now become exposed to his creditors. Even a few weeks in debtor's prison were hard on someone in his 60s. The thin, hunched man who invited Sebastian into his nearly empty parlour looked haggard and ill, his nose red and his eyes watering. He clutched an old blue and red horse blanket around his shoulders for warmth and had a nightcap pulled down over his long silver hair, presumably for the same reason.
"Please, have a seat," he said, indicating one of the two chairs drawn up before the fire.
They were the only pieces of furniture in the room.
"My creditors have taken the settees and carpet and a lovely old table that belonged to my late wife's mother. But fortunately, the stout lad who delivers coal next door was kind enough to hide the chairs in the attic when we saw the bailiffs coming."
The playwright grimaced as he settled again before the fire.
"Unfortunately, I've no doubt they'll be back. It'll be a damnable nuisance, sitting on the floor at my age. But at least they can't rip out the fireplace."
He fussed with the tails of his coat, then frowned up at Sebastian.
"What the devil are you doing here, anyway?"
"I'm told Jane Ambrose was your niece."
"She was, yes."
Sheridan's eyes narrowed. He might have been impoverished and ill, but his mind was still quick and clever.
"Word on the street says she was murdered."
"I take it that's true." "It was either murder or manslaughter. She didn't fall and hit her head in the middle of Shepherd's Lane. That's for certain."
"Well, well," said the old man, shaking his head.
"When was the last time you saw her?"
"Jane? Just last Tuesday."
"She came here?"
"She did. Does that surprise you?"
He gave a bark of laughter that ended in a cough.
"I still had the settees then."
"Did she come to see you often?"
"Often enough. Even rescued me from the Marshalsea last November. It's the worst part about losing my seat in Parliament, you know, having all these bastards hounding me night and day."
"How did she seem when you last saw her?"
"How was she? She was bloody furious, that's how she was. Seems someone told her that His Most Serene Highness, the Hereditary Prince of Orange, is extraordinarily fond of his more attractive male friends and manservants. And she wanted to know if it was a tale or not."
"What did you tell her?"
"The truth, of course."
"Where had she heard about Orange?"
"She never said. She was all a fret about how Princess Charlotte would react should she find out."
Sheridan exhaled his breath in a huff.
"You've seen Orange, skinny as a straw, and those teeth. They don't come much plainer looking or more awkward. According to Jane, the only thing Princess Charlotte likes about the fellow is that she believes him to be direct and honest. Unlike that worthless lying cad of a father of hers. Jane said it would devastate the girl if she ever realizes how she's been taken in by the lot of them."
"She will find out, eventually."
"Oh, undoubtedly."
Sebastian studied the aging playwright's sagging features. His skin was slack and pale, and he needed a shave. But the ghost of his youthful good looks was still there in the strong nose, finely moulded lips, and cleft rounded chin.
"Did you encourage Jane to tell the princess?"
Sheridan stared back at him.
"I did not. Yet I assume you are opposed to the match with Orange."
"Of course I am.
But I didn't advise Jane to tell Charlotte. What would be the point at this stage? The girl will never be allowed to back out of the betrothal now."
Sheridan shifted uncomfortably in his chair.
"You think that's why Jane was killed? Because of Orange? But that makes no sense.
There must be dozens in London who know the truth.
Yes, but how many have Charlotte's ear?
Sheridan blew out a troubled breath.
There is that.
He sat for a time with his gaze on the fire, his brow furrowed with thought. Sebastian said,
"Who do you think killed her?"
Sheridan looked up.
"You mean, besides that worthless husband of hers?"
"Was he faithful to her?"
"Ambrose, what do you think?"
The vehemence of the old man's words caught Sebastian by surprise.
"Of course he wasn't. He was one of the most successful dramatists working today, which means he has opera singers and dancers falling all over themselves to convince him to give them a part. And he's not the sort of man who'd fail to take advantage of that."
"Did Jane know?"
"I assume she did. How could she not? But she never said anything to me about it, if that's what you're asking."
"Was she faithful to him?"
Sheridan gave a derisive grunt.
"You think she'd tell me, her aged, decrepit uncle?"
"What do you know about Liam Maxwell?"
"Maxwell? He's a firebrand."
A slow smile spread across the man's unshaven face.
"I might have alarmed the palace in my day with my support of Catholic emancipation and Irish independence, but Maxwell... Even after 2 years in Newgate, he's still about as radical as they come. Unlike poor Christian. Prison broke him, I'm afraid. Now he publishes rubbishy romances about vampires and dark, mysterious counts."
He gave a derisive snort.
"Can you imagine? He actually bought me one a couple of weeks or so ago. Me! Fortunately, the bailiffs took it."
Sebastian found himself smiling.
"Jane went out to Connaught House last week to see the Princess of Wales. You wouldn't happen to know why, would you?"
The old man looked visibly, genuinely startled.
"She went to see Caroline?"
"Yes." "That surprises you."
"Why?" "I suppose it shouldn't, but..."
He hesitated, his jaw hardening.
"Have you spoken to Jarvis about this?"
"As it happens, yes, I have."
"You're something like the third person to ask me that."
Sheridan cocked one eyebrow.
"Suggestive, wouldn't you say?"
Sebastian studied the clever elderly playwright's wily, unreadable face.
"There's something you're not telling me." "Me?"
Sheridan laughed out loud.
"What could I possibly have to hide?"
"A great deal, I suspect."
But Sheridan only laughed again and refused to be drawn further. Chapter 28. It was shortly after her return from Newgate, while Hero was changing clothes and scrubbing the prison stink from her skin, that she received a message from Miss Ella Kinsworth, alerting her to the princess's plans to venture down to the Thames that afternoon, to observe the strange spectacle of Londoners walking on their river.
"You weren't entirely honest with me," Hero said to Miss Ella Kinsworth, as they strolled along the terrace of Somerset House, overlooking the frozen river.
"Her Royal Highness Princess Charlotte of Wales, clad in white fur trimmed with red ribbons, raced ahead with her dog, an elegant white Italian greyhound."
"I told you what I felt I could," said Miss Kinsworth,
her gaze on the laughing girl and joyously barking dog.
"It wouldn't have been right to repeat the Dutch courtier's words about Valentino Vescovi. I mean, what if the accusations weren't true? I would simply be helping to spread false rumours about an innocent man."
"I'm not sure anyone would describe Valentino Vescovi as an innocent man."
The older woman's eyes crinkled with amusement.
"Probably not."
Hero watched Charlotte chase after her dog, then whirl laughing as the greyhound cavorted around her. The girl might only have just turned 18, but she looked more like 25, with a well-developed figure and mature features. In many ways, she resembled both her mother and her father, with a typical big-boned Hanoverian build
and long nose, although she managed to be considerably more attractive than either parent. Her lips were beautifully moulded, and she had an open, honest expression that was gentle, without being insipid. Yet Hero had to admit that the Duchess of Leeds was right in one sense. There was nothing either elegant or princess-like about Charlotte's ways. She was boisterous and loud and overflowing with boundless energy and good cheer. And while she carried herself with that innate self-confidence unique to those who are born and bred royal, as far as Hero could see, she was utterly lacking in conceit or condescension, or an overweening sense of haughty self-importance. Lady Leeds might condemn that tendency, but Hero found it both admirable and refreshing. So, why did the princess lock Lady Arabella in the water closet last week? Hero asked her friend. Miss Kinsworth pressed the fingers of one hand to her lips to hide a smile. It's wrong of me to laugh, because it was a shocking thing to do, but I can't help it. It was such a well-deserved retribution. Lady Leeds tells everyone that she introduced her daughter into the household as a favour to Charlotte to provide her with a companion closer to her age. But Charlotte despises the girl. She's always finding the little sneak in her bedchamber with no good excuse for being there, or listening at keyholes and creeping about where she has no business to be. That's why Charlotte and I began speaking to each other in German, although that didn't work for long. The older woman shook her head. There's no denying Lady Arabella is clever. She learned German with enviable facility. So we switched to Italian. And now she's learning that. I fear I'm running out of languages. And unlike Her Grace's daughter, I do not acquire new ones easily.
Latin? Suggested Hero with a laugh.
I suspect her little ladyship's Latin is already better than mine. Miss Kinsworth's smile slipped. It didn't occur to me that she might be eavesdropping on my conversations with Jane Ambrose, too. How can someone so young be so conniving?
It must be innate.
What I don't understand is, why all the spying on Charlotte? I suspect it's because both the Regent and Orange are afraid she will try to back out of her betrothal. Hero watched the princess form a snowball and throw it for her dog. Would she do that? If she learned the truth about Orange? I think she might try. She's already furious over the plans to force her to leave England. And honesty is so very important to Charlotte. Hero glanced over at her friend in surprise.
You know, then?
About Orange's disinterest in women? Oh, yes. At least I do now. Unfortunately, I didn't know last December. Otherwise, I would have cautioned her before she agreed to meet him.
Did you tell Jane Ambrose?
About Orange? No.
Toby! Come!
Called the princess. The two women watched together as the girl waded through the snow to the edge of the terrace and stood staring out at a smooth section of the river that was thick with ice skaters. Miss Kinsworth said, It's horrible what Prinny is doing, marrying her to Orange without telling her the truth. After the miserable, lonely childhood she's had, she wants desperately to find love and happiness in her marriage. But there's no chance of that with him as her bridegroom.
It sounds as if Prinny's keeping any number of truths from her.
The dog was frolicking at the princess's feet, wanting to run. But Charlotte stood transfixed by the intricate manoeuvres of a pair of experienced ice gliders. Does she know her father is plotting to divorce her mother as soon as she's out of the country? She doesn't know for certain, but there's no denying she fears it. It's why she's fighting so hard over the marriage contracts, to try to insert a clause saying Orange won't be able to force her to leave England against her will.
Do you think she'll succeed?
Miss Kinsworth looked troubled. I don't know. They watched as Charlotte reached down to scratch the happily panting dog behind its cropped ears. Hero said, The greyhound is lovely. She is, isn't she? She used to belong to Napoleon's empress,
but was taken aboard a French ship captured.
So she's a prisoner of war.
Miss Kinsworth laughed.
I suppose, in a sense, she is. The captain sent her to the prince, except, of course, Prinny hates dogs. So